Welcome to A Little Too Quiet. It's the Ferndale Library Podcast. It's brought to you by the Friends of the Ferndale Library. My name's Jeff. I'm joined by Mary Graham.
Hello, hello.
And we have a fun episode for you today. We literally just finished recording it.
It's so cool, you guys.
Mary Graham, we've talked about this author, this professor, this PhD holding doctorate author in ancient history from the University of Birmingham, coming to us, well, she was live.
Yes, from Belfast.
From Belfast, Emma Sutton, the author of A Fatal Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. And also A Rome of One's Own.
A Rome of One's Own, which is a history of the Roman Empire in 21 women.
In 21 women.
Which I believe is the title in the UK. Mm-hmm. She mentioned they wouldn't let her use the fun title. She's also written a biography of the Empress Agrippina.
That's right. Her thesis on the family in Western Europe after the quote unquote fall of Rome was published as Marriage, Sex, and Death, The Family and the Fall of Rome. And that has, that this has kind of been her bag, is experience, is like exploring family, sex, gender, politics, murder in ancient Rome.
Yes.
She's the OG of being obsessed with ancient Rome.
Well,
at least in our modern times.
Yes. She's one of my favorite historical writers, nonfiction writers working right now. Mm-hmm. So it was so exciting, an absolute pleasure to get to chat with her, because her books are kind of the reason I'm interested in Rome at all, beyond what I had to contend with in my undergrad degree, learning about medieval Europe. Mm-hmm. God, no one loves the Romans like medieval Europeans, which baffled me as an undergrad, because I was like, but those guys sucked, and they kept their empire, it quite famously fell
right
before the Europeans, mm-hmm, in the Middle Ages. Why would they want to go back to it? And mm-hmm, and reading her books made me change from these guys suck and I hate reading about them to these guys suck and I can't stop reading about them. They're so fascinating.
That's right. So fascinating.
She has a lot of really insightful stuff to say about why we should still study Rome, mm-hmm, what there is for us to learn today, both about Rome and about ourselves, which I think is what a lot of the pursuit of history and historical study is figuring, yeah, out, learning about ourselves through learning about other times and places.
Yeah, A Fatal Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Murder in Ancient Rome. This is a book that has come up on the podcast a few times, but as Mary Graham said, Emma Sutton did just put toward the end of 2023, A Rome of One's Own. So we're going to have more information in our show notes, but let's roll right on in to the conversation with Dr. Emma Sutton. Here's our chat.
And I happen to be friends as well with H.R. Owen. Hero and I are internet friends. Yeah, so when I told them that we got to talk to you, they were like, oh my goodness, it's like podcast synthesis, like between Traveling Light, History is Sexy, and A Little Too Quiet. They were like, we're just gonna podcast nerd empire. So
yeah, gradually we're gonna take over the world.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm glad. I love Hero. Yeah, they're one of my favorites.
Yeah, hopefully some libraries in the UK could start their own podcasts, because it's a very,
yeah,
it's become a very American and Michigan thing. We know a lot of libraries that do it.
Really? So my mom, she just retired, but she was a librarian. And then in a very strange part of bit of nepotism, my sister took her job. So gradually my family is taking over Sussex libraries. But I don't know, they just, they have no money and they have no time. So, but they probably get volunteers to do it. But everybody who volunteers there, my sister is the youngest person there by probably about 25 years. So
I would say that
there are not that many young librarians anymore.
Roughly. Well, we have a lot of young folks working at the library here, but I would say that in terms of volunteers, it's roughly the, that screen just went dark. Jeff.
Oh, there, no, we're good.
Sorry.
Didn't mean to break anything.
The library volunteer folks do tend to be the people who have retired because now they have time to volunteer.
Is now one of them.
It's our volunteer friends group who is the reason that we have the podcast, because they gave us the startup money for all the equipment. Aww. Is that right, Jeff? We're brought to you by the Friends of the Ferndale Library.
Yes, this is a community supported situation going on here, but we also consider the podcast to be a form of social media. We want our patrons to enjoy this. We want to be able to bring our patrons the opportunity to hear interviews with authors way across the proverbial pond, thousands of miles away.
And the
from
literal
us.
Pond, yeah.
Yeah. And it's like a public radio station where I bother you into inviting authors I want to talk to.
Yes, this has happened. This has happened before. It'll happen again. Mary Graham is very well read, and that's why she came onto the podcast. This became a literary podcast. It became it started as a Things You Don't Know About Libraries podcast, but it kind of became a literary podcast. And so to begin with you, Emma, and especially about a fatal thing happened on the way to the forum, Mary Graham and a prior employee had a lot of ideas for this podcast early on. And one day they said, am I misremembering this incorrectly? Mary Graham was like, we should do an entire podcast inspired by the Ides of March. You guys were really passionate about that.
Yeah, well, no, it was because I think last year we did a podcast that was in March. I think it was our Women's Wrongs podcast. Because
we support women's rights.
But of course, we also support women's wrongs,
right,
which is a great thing. And so quite easily we fell into discussing Roman history, because as Jeff and I were discussing before we turned the mics on, like anytime a woman kills her husband in Roman history, I'm like, well, that's... You can't argue with that.
They were probably right.
That's sure. And even if they weren't, I also support women's wrongs. But I think we recorded that episode on the Ides of March. And because Roddy and I both spend possibly more time than we should on the internet, there are quarters in the internet where Ides of March shitposting is an art.
Yeah.
And so
I'm guessing if you know Hero, you're a big Tumblr fan.
Yeah, that's how Hero and I met. So
yeah, they love the Ides of March.
It's very fun.
And gathering together to stab in groups.
Exactly. Yeah. It's enrichment for for the friend group. And Roddy, my former coworker, went to an undergraduate program that's what over here is called the Great Books curriculum. So it started with like Homer and went forward. So she's got a lot of classical education, even though she was an English major. She has a lot more classical education than I do. So I read Fatal Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum and like threw it at her. And she was like, "Ooh, it's all of my favorite terrible people." And then I think we were working on badgering you to do an Ides of March podcast.
That's right.
She's moved on to greater glory in another job, although she's stuck with being friends with me forever. So
that's right.
Here I am. and excited to talk about terrible Roman people.
That's right. But we've also talked about Shakespeare on this podcast, which means we talked about Julius Caesar, the play. But then there have been all these instances, at least three or four, where Emma Southern's book, Fatal Thing, just kind of came up in conversation. And we're like, this is a running.
Well, and then when you just had your new book come out, I read it as soon as I could get my hands on a copy and loved it, and was like, you know, okay, it's new book promo season, Jeff, like the iron is hot. Now is the time to strike. So yeah, we wanted to talk to you about, I mean, anything about your books that you want to talk about, but I know Jeff and I are both particularly interested in writing like really well researched history for a popular audience, and also like historiography for a popular audience. Because something I loved about A Rome of One's Own, which is your, for listeners, History of the Roman Empire and 21 Women.
Also pun intended.
Also pun intended. Jeff is our resident punster.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, and rare
is... they wouldn't let me use that on the UK edition, but it's such a good pun.
Rare is the day when he doesn't say something that has the rest of us going,
ugh. Yeah. Yeah, so that might happen. I haven't planned it yet, but that might happen.
The thing is, you don't plan yours. They're not prefabs. That's they just, right. It's like in Pride and Prejudice where Lizzie's like, Mr. Collins, do these compliments arise from the spirit of the moment? Or are they planned out before? Yours are always the spirit of the moment.
True.
But something I loved about A Rome of One's Own is how much time you deliberately spend talking about like how history is done, and how it's not just like, you know, oh, this woman lived from here to there.
Yeah. I think that is the least interesting part of history to me, is like the final story almost, because you strip out all of the good bits. If you just do, you know, this woman lived from X to Y and did A, B, C, then you strip out the fun part, which is what my friend Innes calls being a time detective, which I've now stolen and I'm using, which is the bit where you get to kind of dig through and be like, okay, so how do we know about this woman? So we know about, I don't know, say Lucretia, for example, from poems and from histories, and which are all written in this 50-year period during the reign of Augustus. And so, okay, so we don't actually know about her. We know about what some men 700 years later thought about her. And they're all specifically writing during a particular political time. Okay, so that's interesting. So why are they now constructing it like this? Because it's all, you know, constructed storytelling of its time. And I think that sometimes you get this idea with particularly ancient history, but as though all ancient history was told without any guile or artifice whatsoever. They were just writing down because they were ancient people, and they were just like writing down exactly what they thought happened with big wide eyes, and they believed completely uncomplicatedly in everything they wrote down, as though they weren't also working within complex literary traditions and within genres and working with their language and trying to, much as historians do now and writers do now, you know, trying to write beautiful sentences as much as they are trying to write history and talking to the people that they know are going to read their histories, as well as they are, you know, just writing what they think about history. And that time detective part where you go, okay, how do we know about this person? Who wrote about this person? Where did they know about this person? What kind of tradition were they writing in? Is more fun to me than just telling the straight story. I basically am going to just change my bio to Emma Southern Time Detective.
Time Detective. that concept of cliche of like history is a living thing has never been more coherently explained to me than what just happened over the last 45 seconds. I get it. I get it. It's
Thank you.
Yes.
And yeah, I also think this idea of like, you know, oh, and they were writing without any guile. Like, I'm sitting here being like, have you met an ancient Roman? Like, those guys seemed like the messiest bitches alive, which is, or dead, as it would happen.
They're so messy.
Which is why I've really enjoyed your books, because before I picked up A Fatal Thing Happened to the Forum, on the way to the Forum, I studied medieval art history and literature in undergrad. And so you spend a lot of time talking about like, okay, and this guy wanted to do this because it's like Rome. This guy's always connecting himself to Rome. And for the longest time, I was like, why are they doing this? Do they, the Rome, they keep falling. They can't keep an emperor. There's like four guys in 1 year. Like, why is this someone that you would want to emulate? And so my attitude was kind of like, ugh, the Romans, I hate those guys and I hate reading about them. And then I picked your book up because the title was so fabulous. And I was like, oh, the Romans, these guys are the worst, and I love reading about them.
And I love.
Like, it was precisely because of that historiography and because of that, like, okay, well, and how do we know about this? And is this person, you know, like, okay, we've got a lot of stuff from Cicero, but it's Cicero. Like,
but Cicero is simultaneously the world's greatest self-propagandist and the bitchiest man that ever lived.
Exactly.
Which is great. But it also, he will, you know, he's, I love to hate Cicero because he's so funny, and everybody like has very much like immediately after he died, he became like this guy that everybody adored, and like everybody talked about just how they considered him to be the greatest orator and the greatest guy of all time. And they kind of airbrushed out the bits of his history that they didn't really like. They just talked about his oratory essentially, and the bit of like where he executed a man without trial and all the rest kind of get brushed out. But you read his letters and you read his like his own version of himself is that, and it's so funny because he'd literally be like, me, the best of Romans, and he calls himself this all the time, and he gets so upset when people don't give him the respect that he feels that he deserves. But at the same time, he will write all these letters being like, oh my god, you won't believe who fell over in the forum the other day. And like that kind of part of him, that ego and that gossipy, like Truman Capote gossipiness, is so delightful.
And like thinking about being a time detective, like those are my favorite things of history, is I'm like, yeah, no, I do want to know who fell over in the forum. Who was it?
I do.
Tell me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm so happy that this is, I'm like, the point of like human advancement or whatever is so that we could invent a writing system that can survive long enough that I can know who fell down in the forum 2,000 years ago. I wish to know this.
See, I'm the same. I always wish to know, like, I want to know who's having petty fights. I basically love gossip, and history for me is a large part gossip about dead people. And so I really love all of the bits where you find out that like two people had a fight over the price of a book, or somebody accidentally punched a consul in the baths because they mistook them for an enslaved person, or like the little dramas of human life that happen all the time, like Tiberius falling over his own toga when somebody tried to prostrate themselves at his feet, and he was so fostered that he stepped backwards and tripped over his own toga and then fell down some stairs is my favorite story in the whole of Roman history.
If only we could have been there.
I had never heard that one, but when you think about like how much fabric a toga is, they seem like wildly inconvenient clothes.
They're deliberately inconvenient clothes, like because they're 2 meters long and they're made of heavy wool. And the point is that you wear them and it prevents you from really being able to do anything apart from speak and think. And it shows, having a toga and wearing one shows that you have enough money and enough resources to have people who've put that on for you, because you cannot put them on yourself. Like you need at least 2 people to do it for you. And also shows that you don't have to do anything other than be a senator. Like you don't have to do any business, you don't have to, you're not going to have to be doing any lifting or carrying, you're just going to be holding this toga and standing very straight. And it's a real sign of like having all of this wealth and privilege that people do your stuff for you. And it's also really hot and uncomfortable.
Wow.
And sometimes people fell over them, which is funny.
So what was it, about 6 or 8 months ago, it's kind of gone away, as these trends do, all over TikTok, everyone was theorizing that men in general were always constantly thinking of the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. And I, do you remember that trend going around? How did you feel when you heard about that trend?
And everybody I know sent it to me.
Of course.
I first heard of it because my friend sent it to me and said, what does it feel like to be in one of the very few heterosexual couples whereby you definitely think about this more than your husband?
A long way to say
it, I feel special.
A long way to say is to just pull that out. For the listener who hasn't read your book yet, where that obsession came from for you, where that fascination came from?
The Romans. So I did Roman history purely on a whim when I was 16. So when you're 16 in the UK, finish compulsory education, mm-hmm. And then you can do A levels, which is like 16 to 18 pre-university, and you can kind of specialize a bit. So you go down from doing like 11 subjects to doing just 10, like 3 or 4 subjects. And I kind of liked history, but I hated doing World War II, which is the only history that we did at like 16. And I never wanted to learn about another European treaty ever again. Or anything more about Hitler and Stalin. So, but my college that I went to did ancient history. And if you did ancient history, then you got to go on trips to Greece and Rome, which I wanted to do. My plan at the time was I was going to be a psychologist. So I thought this would just be like a fun thing to do as my like fourth A level. And so I did that. And then we did Aristophanes the Frogs for the first thing they did, and then we did Suetonius's Life of the 12 Caesars and started reading that, and I was like, okay, these guys are amazing.
I was thinking like go ahead.
no one was doing any treaties. It was all just like bizarre people doing deeply bizarre things, and their jokes are largely about penises. It was just making like, it was just so deeply funny and silly and human in a way that modern history had never been made to me, that I just fell head over heels and then kept trying to stop doing Roman history, but just never liked anything ever as much as I did about, they're so horrible. And like everything about them is horrible. They're horrible. Even when they're describing like their greatest virtues, you're like, that's horrible. Mm-hmm. Their greatest virtues, like we're really rich and we conquered the entire world. You're like, wow, that sucks. like, look how great I am. I own 4,000 people. You're like, Jesus Christ, that's horrific. And so that's like the best things that they have to say about themselves. And everything that they do is kind of grim, but also there's this real disconnect between how they view themselves as literally the most virtuous and brilliant people who ever existed and how they are in everyday life, which is happy slave owners who brutalized the world, who, like, it will extract every resource from everything, and who very often just kill one another, and who at best are, like, just quite cruel and bitchy and mean, and I just find that fascinating and never stopped, and now I can't get away from it.
I kind of feel like you still wind up being some sort of a psychoanalyst with all of these complicated brains anyway. And
I think so.
Well, and
I
was just gonna say, I think that that description of, like, wow, they are just, like, killing each other all the time, but they also think they're the best, is I have started watching HBO's Rome, I'm, like, halfway through the second season, and there's only two of them now. But that's such... You've put your finger on something that, like, is the reason I can't quit that show, even though I'm like, my God, so many people are dead. And it's because, like, you have, like Lucius Verinus, like, one of the main characters, and his whole thing is, like, you know, oh, yeah, I believe in the Republic, and I'm so pious, and, like, this is a proper upright Roman family. And he is always this close to killing his wife, who he, like, proclaims to absolutely adore, and in his own way does. And, like, spoilers for listeners who haven't seen the full first season of Rome, but, like, he doesn't kill her, but he effectively kills her. And, like, he is about to, and she decides to do it herself, which I guess is fairly Lucretia of her. And with a name like Niobe, she was not going to have a happy ending anyway. But that tension there of, like, yeah, like, all these, you know, because that's sort of the downstairs story of Rome, and then the show, and then you have the upstairs story of, like, oh, and here's Kieran Hines as Julius Caesar giving one of the greatest performances. Like, watching him, I was like, I get it. Like, so much of what I've enjoyed about watching that show is the actual visual spectacle of it all. Like, the episode where he rides into Rome in triumph, I'm like, oh, okay. Because you read about it, but seeing a really high-budget TV show be like, no, we pulled all these Italian extras in here so that you could get a sense of what that would have been like. And, like, that's what I really appreciate about your writing, is when you sort of encourage the reader to stop and think about, like, what it would have been like the gladiatorial games in Fatal Thing, and thinking about, like, yeah, it would have looked kind of cool when they pulled that sword out and there was a lot of blood. Like, admit that to yourself. It doesn't necessarily feel good to admit, but it would have looked kind of cool. Like,
we're all like, oh God, that's terrible. Like, oh, I would never want to see, like, don't even want to think about, like, the fighting to the death thing and the stabbing in the throat. That seems awful. But 100% people would go. People would go and watch, and they, like, a bit of you, even, like, little wusses like me who don't even like to watch boxing because they hit them too hard, would be like, that's kind of cool though. Like, a bit of me would think that was kind of cool.
Sure.
And then I feel bad about it, but still.
But tell us about your approach to writing, because it can go into this conversational tone where you really do talk about, maybe, how do you think about the audience when you're writing these books, and how to engage them.
I think about the book that I would want to read more than anything. That is, like, the main thing that is always at the back of my head. Like, did I, when I'm rereading it, like, have I made myself laugh? if I'm enjoying writing, I usually think it will be enjoyable to read. But I'm always really wary of, I never want to fall into, like, lecturing tone, which thankfully did never came easy to me, even when I was writing for academics. Never want to, because I feel like a lot of nonfiction books feels like someone is standing at a podium telling you things, and is not actually trying, like, not actually really aware almost that there is a reader there. But I always, and I feel like that's a weakness of some historical writing, which is that you read it and you have to force yourself to stop and think and go, okay, well, what is this actually like? Like, what is the physical experience of this? And so I kind of... build that in, of, like, making the reader, I'm aware that there is a reader holding the book, and that's who it's for, and I always want to say to them, like think about it, like, it's not that weird that they do this. It sounds weird because we have described it like this, but it's not, as an experience, not hugely different to something that you already know. Like, you already know what it's like to be in a crowd of, like, if you've seen Taylor Swift in concert, you know what it's like to be in a crowd of 100,000 people. Or if you've ever been to like a massive sports game, you know what it's like. Okay, but now those 100,000 people are everyone that worked for the emperor. And that's how many people worked for the emperor. So now you can kind of imagine that on a scale that makes sense to you. And then you can go into the next thing that I say, kind of with an understanding that that is of what that actually means. And so I suppose I always want it to be something that I would enjoy reading, something that I get something out of, like if I was, as I'm writing it and reading it. And also, yeah, I don't read that many nonfiction books because I have a job, and most of my reading is done either on the bus on the way home or like in the evenings. Or, and so I think that most people, that's how they read. Like most people don't have time to sit down and read for a whole day or read something that's dense and lectury. And it's a minority of people who have the energy to do that, and I'm not one of them. So I always want books that are going to entertain me and draw me along with them and surprise me and make me laugh. And those are the ones that I'll keep reading, like that you want to get, that you want to get out on the bus because you want to find out what happens next, or what horrible fact I'm going to tell you that you can then go to work and tell your friends.
You have correctly assessed what kind of workplace we have here. And that was one of my favorite things about all of your books, but A Rome of One's Own in particular, is I read it over the course of a week or two precisely because I could pick it up and put it down, and I wanted to pick it up when I got home late at night, but also it was nice. I could be like, well, okay, there's 21 women here. I can read one woman and on my lunch break and things like that. And I wanted to ask you about, I mean, the process of like choosing the people you covered in that book, and if there is a particular, like, was there someone you were really excited to write about, or is there someone that you're always, that in the process you were like, everybody shut up, I have to tell you about this person who's not one of the like three women that we already knew a lot about, or anything like that?
So the process was guided really pragmatically by the fact that I knew I wanted it to be from beginning to end. So I had to start at the beginning, and then I arbitrarily chose the end as around about 410. Like Romulus Augustulus is, and the deposition is what I chose as the end of. Once Rome's not in the empire, I don't think you can legitimately call it the Roman Empire. And then I knew that I wanted someone from every period. So there is always this tendency, because there are periods where you know loads about things. So the reason that all books are about the late Republic and the first 12 emperors is because that's what we know the most about, and there's a bunch of sources about those periods, and there's very little about like the Middle Republic, and there's this huge, like, there's one emperor that we know nothing about. Like, we know his name and vaguely what he looked like, but Antoninus Pius, just he just ruled for 25 years and we know nothing about him.
I feel like that's kind of a win though, because like, imagine, again, the people who had four emperors in 1 year, being the guy who's like, I'm here for 25 years and was it boring? Yes, but it was boring. I mean, you don't want to live in interesting times. We've all learned that now.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it was a very boring, very delightful time, but I needed like people from his time and like so I knew I had that mapped out, and then, phase one was finding women for every phase, which was quite tough for some of them. Like the Middle Republic is an absolute dead zone. And like some periods around like the five good emperors, of which there were actually six. So I found them, and then whittling down those periods that are really dense with women. So there were some that got kind of cut out because I had two or three that were within a couple of decades. And so you don't want the whole book to be just about that one period and pretend that Roman history is like a 100 year period, because it's not, it's like 1,000 years. And so I lost some women that were quite good fun, either because they were telling a story that had already been told. Like some of them were too close to the emperor, because I also didn't want it to be just imperial stories. And some of them would like one called Calvia Crispinilla, who has this great story in that she is like a courtier of Nero, and she is made that his like when he picks up Sporus, who is this boy that he castrates and makes his wife, and then takes around with him as his wife for a good few years, and who seems to love him and is like the last woman man standing, person standing when he dies. There's like him, Sporus, his other mistress Acte, and then two of his nurses. They're like the four people that still stay with Nero, but she becomes his like right hand man. And then when Nero is overthrown, she attempts to starve Rome to death by taking over Alexandria, and so she has quite a cool story. And then she just retires from politics and runs a massive olive oil empire from Croatia,
which is quite cool.
Yeah, but she lived pretty much during the exact same time as Boudica, so I had to pick between Boudica or Cartamandua or her. The one that I knew, there were a few that I knew were always going to be there. Julia Felix was one who my friend Sophie Hay, who works at Pompeii, so she's an archaeologist at Pompeii, told me about, because she's obsessed with Julia Felix. And as soon as I started reading about Julia's like complex that she has, and the fact that she runs it by herself, and then the fact that she has this, she gets a road move, she builds this entire bath so that she can take advantage of passing traffic. She really makes the most out of the earthquake that happens before Vesuvius went off. And then she has that mural of like the forum during market day, which shows all these people just doing normal things, and it shows how wild the Romans are, because one of the normal things they have is a man who is naked being beaten with a cane. You're like, yes, a normal thing to paint on your wall,
just a Sunday morning.
Like, here are some school children and here is a naked man being beaten with a cane. Cool, normal. But yeah, Julia Felix is technically we know so little about her, but it feels like you know so much about her from how she decorated and ran her business.
I was going to say she was one of my favorite chapters precisely because of that, because there is so much about just like daily life in that chapter about like, okay, yeah, this woman that we don't know a ton of facts about, but we can extrapolate so much based on the archaeological like connections that we have to her. I found that so, so neat. I also really loved the chapter on Perpetua, and thought that it was very interesting, the point that you make about between the huge shift that happens between Perpetua and Galla Placidia, with it's incomprehensible to Perpetua's father. Like, she would not be able to say, I am a Roman and I am a Christian. And then what is it, like, not 200 years later with Galla Placidia? She's able to say, you know, Romana Christiana sum, like, I'm a Roman Christian. Yep. And that just made my little brain go, because, like, I'm somewhat familiar with the story of Perpetua and Felicity. I grew up in an Episcopal household. My father's a priest. But, like, not, I'm familiar with it from the hagiography sort of side of things and not the historical perspective on the hagiography side of things, which I find fascinating. And I know that you talk sometimes about something that you always are up to talk about, but no one ever lets you talk about, is like early Christianity in Rome. And I think you said that on a History of Sexy podcast, and I was like, but I want it though. People should let you talk about it
anytime, because all I ever want to talk about is that. That's what my like master's degree was on, and then a big chunk of my PhD as well was on like the shift from Christianity being a sect to Christianity being a religion, which is a different thing. Like, a sect is something like they're apocalyptic for a long time, and then the shift from being apocalyptic and being able to just continually be sacrificing your members over and over again and telling them not to have babies and to give up their families into, oh no, wait, hang on, we need a theology of marriage, we need a theology of family, we need a theology of continuation, and a religion that can perpetuate itself is a big shift that has to happen really quickly.
And oh, I no, guys. I think he didn't just run around the corner for milk. I don't think he'll be back tomorrow. He could be, but we can't be sure. That's a shift.
It's been a while.
That's a shift that really, really interests me. I once heard someone describe early Christianity as like a doomsday cult that escaped containment. And yeah. There is part of me that's like, no, that's true. Like, yeah, that's fair. That's a fair assessment of us early on. So so I found that really, really interesting. Your chapter on Boudicca and Cartimandua as well, because I'm a huge fan of the podcast You're Dead to Me. And the very first episode was you talking about Boudicca. And so I was like, yes, reprise. Because, again, I think that that's... I also think that certainly to... maybe a lot of Americans or just folks who aren't familiar with that much Roman history, you know, if I had said, oh, I'm reading this book about Roman women, I don't think any of my friends would be like, oh, is Boudicca in it? But like,
right.
Of course, she is part of the history of the Roman Empire.
Right.
So, yeah.
And the struggle, I think a lot of people don't think of her as Roman or being in the Roman world, even though she is a Roman subject, and she lives within the Roman Empire for her pretty much her entire life, as far as we can tell. And it's the same with a bunch of the women that I included, which I did on purpose. Like Zenobia is never seen as a Roman woman. She's a Roman citizen. She lives in the Roman Empire. She never lives outside of the Roman Empire or leaves the Roman Empire. She fights and calls herself a Roman. She mints coins calling herself Augusta. She writes in Latin. She is a Roman, but she is always called an interloper or an invader. She is called Syrian, as though Syria has no Roman history. But like North Africa and the Levant and all the way down into Iraq and chunks of Iran have these really powerful Roman histories and were part of the Roman Empire, and these people were Roman citizens. And so... I didn't set out to do this, but I ended up with that book inadvertently talking a lot about how women kind of demonstrate how fragile the concept of Roman is, and how, particularly in modern historiography, there is this real desire to have Roman mean white man from Italy, and to specifically mean like these guys who live in this city, and all of the people who have citizenship and live in the Roman Empire for their entire lives and for generations and generations are somehow not Roman. They are Roman, like they're just in the Roman Empire, but they are still kind of cut up according to modern ideas of what they are. So they're North African or they're something else, but they're all Roman because that's what being Roman meant.
You're just expanding the spotlight. You're kicking these guys out of the spotlight.
Yeah.
I love it.
Just pulling back a little bit. Yeah. Like, I think that we often get a very kind of, there's a very kind of personality focused often on like 12 guys.
Right.
Can be very kind of close up. But when you just wide lens it a little bit, you get more interesting stories.
And I think that wide lens as well helps really answer the question of what puzzled me so much in undergrad of why do these people want to say that they're Roman all the time? Those guys sucked. Which when you think about like Byzantium and the Eastern Roman Empire, for the longest time, they would have been like, well, but we're Rome, like we're Roman Christians, we're Roman, yeah. Even though all of our liturgies are in Greek, but like it's Rome, guys, we're Rome. And when you pull back and point out how big the Roman Empire was,
right.
and that Zenobia was Roman, or like Augustine of Hippo. I just read a great book about him and the women in the Confessions. Kate Cooper, exactly. I love her work. Like all of that, it's all Roman, and I both find that much more interesting than 12 guys in togas, although I do want to hear every time they trip over them, and also that. The fact that identity, that so many people claimed that identity and had that identity, and that was a big part of actually their experience, also helps it make sense to me that so many people, you know, say in medieval Europe were like, well, yeah, we want that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the empire building had a lot to do with it also, but, you know, it. Fun fact about Kate Cooper's latest book, which I think is Queens of a Fallen World. So my cat doesn't want me to read about the Roman Empire. And and it's my own fault, wow, because her name is Lucy and I named her after the saint who was martyred under Rome. And so I'm like, oh, this little cat has taken her namesake a little too seriously and is like, we don't need to. So anytime I try to read a book about the Roman Empire, she sits on it. And one might say, well, Mary Graham, it's just because they're all hardcover books and she likes sitting, sure, in the little, yeah, V shape on your lap. And I say, no, no, but she doesn't do that with my books about other things. She's like, ooh, St. Augustine, sit. Ooh, 21 women in the Roman Empire, sit.
Fascinating.
Not today. Which I just think is very funny. And I know that you have a cat named after an empress, and I thought you would enjoy the fact that my cat is...
who has destroyed one book in the 11 years that I have owned her, and I own a lot of books, like I'm sitting in a room full of books. Mm-hmm. She has destroyed one book in my entire time, and that is one copy of Suetonius's Lives of the Roman Emperors, Lives of Caesars, which she scratched like a scratching pole until it had a hole in the middle, and then weed on it.
She was like, no more.
She's never done it
no
before.
No more of
She's
these
never done
guys.
It since. Yeah.
Oh my.
I think she is resigned now that I will sometimes pay more attention to them than I do to her.
Wow, that's amazing.
Maybe cats hate Rome. Maybe that's...
I mean, maybe they're like... Because now that I'm thinking about this, Lucy's never done it with anything I'm reading about Egypt. Mm. And it must be because she's like, well, those guys...
Cats hate Rome.
They're...
We've all covered a conspiracy.
Yeah. They're like, well, obviously, we're all in this for the Egyptians because they loved us.
Sure.
And we hate Rome. Mm-hmm. So, yep, you're right. You heard
Romans
it here first.
Are dog
folks.
People. So, yeah.
That's true.
Romans loved dogs. Like, there are all these really lovely, like, epitaphs for dogs and things. Like, they had pet cemeteries and they would put up, like, big, long epitaphs about how much they loved their dogs. And they have these, like, they have mosaics of them. Like, you do not get that many of cats.
That explains so much about them to me for some reason.
It does. They were very much dog people. Although it is very funny to imagine them having, they had like little Maltese dogs were their favorites. Like that's their little lap dogs, like, you know, the little white fluffy ones.
Oh my God.
And so there was a real thing for tiny little dogs in the Roman Empire.
I'm just
so
imagining.
So you can now imagine Cicero with a tiny little Maltese dog.
Basically, I'm like, oh my God, like these guys who are like, I'm a giant of rhetoric. I'm a savior of the republic. Who's a good doggy? Who's a good doggy? Like, that is
Here's my baby.
So funny to me.
Let me ask you a question that you have no business being forced to answer. But to go back to that silly little TikTok trend of being obsessed with the Roman Empire, because I think this could perhaps be a teaser for folks to dive into your two most recent books. Why would anyone or should anyone be obsessed with the Roman Empire? That could be, tease them into your book with that.
Okay. I think that it is interesting to be, I think it's important to read properly about the Roman Empire because so much of UK and US kind of ideology about what we are is derived from an imagined version of the Romans. Like, the UK built its empire on the basis that it was building a new Roman Empire. And if you've ever walked through London or Bath or any of those kind of high empire places, then you see that they built most of their buildings to look like temples, Roman temples. Mm-hmm. And the US did the exact same thing when it started a Senate. It built it on principles of an imagined version of the Roman Republic.
It's working out great for us.
Worked out great for the Romans too. But they like those kind of foundations which come out of the first the Renaissance and then the Enlightenment and these kind of revolutionary period, which are the foundations of the world that we now live in, come from a version of the Roman Empire which was dreamt up essentially by a bunch of guys who saw themselves in Cicero and Seneca and Caesar and thought, you know what sounds great? The ideal of reason, the ideal of men ruling, slavery, and imperialism. Mm-hmm. And they thought all of those things sounded so brilliant that they would basically build ideologies upon them. And it is, I think, important to look at what the Roman world was really like and what we are really looking at when we say this is what we want our world to be like, and what the lives of other people were like in that world, so that we actually understand what we're saying we want to be like. Like, do we really want to be the Roman Empire? Because the Roman Empire has all of these terrible things in it. And you know what? If you want to say you want to be the Roman Empire, then I'm going to force you to say, yeah, I love slavery. And I think that women shouldn't be allowed to vote. And at least then we all know where you stand. Because that is what you're saying when you're saying that you want the world to be like the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. I also think that it is important then to complicate that history and say, okay, so women couldn't vote, but this is what they could do. And okay, they had slavery, and this is what it was like to live as a slave or as an enslaved person, and this is what that kind of experience was like, and this is like the extreme decadence of the Roman Empire, but also how they could like crush anybody that they wanted to under their tiny little thumb. And to then, once you complicate that picture, it undermines its power as something that you can build it on, because you can say, okay, but it was never actually like that. Like, it was never glorious. It was always just people falling over. They aren't gods amongst men. They are just men. And there was nothing perfect about the ancient world, because they're all silly, because all humans are silly. And then you can complicate, you know, how people then want to build the modern world. And also it's fun, which is the main reason I got into it, which was because I just love people, and I love hearing people's stories. And if they're dead, then I don't have to feel bad about gossiping about them.
So what you're saying, as a time detective historian, you don't come to bury Caesar and don't come to praise him.
Correct.
Okay.
I come to dig him up.
That's what I got.
Tell him he's
a jet. I can't even be
mad
about that.
But then to not praise.
But then, yeah. Actually, one of my favorite, so in addition to medieval literature, I did early modern as well, and a lot of Shakespeare. And for the same reasons, like, I think one of the reasons I connect so much with your books is that it sounds like you got into studying Roman history for the same reason I did my English degree, which was like, medieval people are also messy bitches who like making jokes about penises. Like, that is it's humans have always been humans. But I recently, for the first time, watched a production of Julius Caesar. It's the National Theater production with Ben Whishaw as Brutus, which is very good. And I had this moment of like, yeah, no wonder that like Shakespeare handshake the guys who wrote HBO Rome. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a good story. No wonder we are still making effectively theater out of it. But an interesting thing about the Ides of March trend is folks on TikTok either doing their own sort of modern interpretations of Antony's funeral speech from Julius Caesar, the play, or the best performance of that speech I've ever heard is a guy sitting in his car with aviator sunglasses, and he's got this lovely Southern American accent. Yeah. And he delivers it like somebody would deliver a eulogy at like a funeral for my family members. Wow. Who are all from the Southern US. And I'm so fascinated in like how he got from in 44 BC, a guy got stabbed because he wanted to be a king slightly too much by people who didn't want kings.
Didn't want that.
And then Shakespeare wrote a play about it, because basically his whole education system was founded on learning about these guys. Mm-hmm. And
there's Plutarch in between. So
Plutarch,
Shakespeare,
okay,
takes it from Plutarch, who's like 200 years later. So he writes his biographies. And then Shakespeare gets it from Plutarch.
Yeah.
And Plutarch is writing in a completely different milieu of like, oh yeah, obviously Caesar was the greatest guy that ever lived, and it was very bad that he got killed.
And then you have us with our little pocket computers filming each other in our cars,
making jokes about group projects,
making jokes about
text chains.
Yeah, agree about that. He only got stabbed 23 times. A lot of people did not do their part in the group project.
Exactly.
A lot of people did. It's a very bad hit rate.
Yeah. So, and didn't they at some point like start hitting each other because there was so much chaos? They started like missing.
At least one person gets stabbed. Yeah. But I figure a lot of them, you know, again, he's wearing a toga. Like that's a lot of fabric to get through. So mm-hmm. probably some of them had a go and it just got stuck in the fabric.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as I said before, some of them just didn't make a cut.
Yeah. Wow.
Mm-hmm. This every day. Every day. This is how we live. Oh.
I cut you off though. Oh no, that's, sorry. Mm-hmm. That's another one.
No, that's all I was going to say after that is just I feel like the what is it, BuzzFeed Unsolved? I've connected dots. You haven't connected shit. I've connected them. Like, you know, like thinking about all of this or like, you know, Pepe Silvia red string conspiracy board. Mm-hmm. It was one of my favorite things about history is it just makes my brain go.
Exactly.
And yeah. It's fun
when you start tracing stuff back and you really like, and you can just keep going back and like, you know, you go, okay, so the British Museum looks like a Roman temple. Why does the British Museum look like a Roman temple? Because it's filled with stuff that the British took from the empire and they mm-hmm. thought they were Romans. Why did they think they were Romans? Because Petrarch basically rediscovered the Romans and thought that they were great and kickstarted their Renaissance. Okay, why did he think that they were so great? Because he read Cicero and Cicero mm-hmm. thinks this and Cicero and Seneca said these secrets. Okay, so why do they think that? Because they're Stoics, which comes from Greece, and then you're back in Greece. And you're like, okay, so why are people... And then you can just keep going back forever. And then before you know it, you're in Mesopotamia and the foundation of agriculture. And people selling bad copper to each other.
Yep. If he didn't want us to still be dragging him all these years later, he should have sold better copper.
And that's how you get from the British Museum to
yeah, to
bad salesman. Yeah, and you could, and it happens with ideas and with everything. You know, like why do men wear suits is a thing that we did on the podcast recently. And you stuck, okay, men wear suits because of this kind of revolution in clothing in the 19th century and the end of like, but it all goes back to Charles II and this idea of wanting to get rid of introducing, kind of counter-reformation and reformation ideas of thrift. Okay, so why have we got the counter-reformation and the reformation? Because of da-da-da. And then you're back to the popes and the introduction of papal authority, and it's great.
And then you're back to Rome.
And then you're back to Rome. And then you're back to, like, two guys fighting over who gets to be pope in the street.
Yes, I love when the answer to who can we blame for this is Protestants. And I say that as a Protestant.
It's almost always Protestants.
It's almost always Protestants. And I love being like, what did we do this time? What did they do this time? Because there's different flavors of Protestant. Sure. But then also
so many.
I love reading about as an Episcopalian, quite famously, we don't care about the Pope. It's like our thing. Mm-hmm. But I love reading about the history of popes mm-hmm. because anti-popes are deeply amusing to me.
Mm-hmm. Anti-popes are my favorite thing pretty much in the world, the idea of two guys. And it, like you get quite big periods. It's really hard to imagine now. I think it's because like everything has been very peaceful with popes for my entire life and I've just kind of known them as those guys who are over there. And I grew up Methodist, so we also don't have like a big pope situation going on. But like they were like it was John Paul and then there were some guys and like it's all very peaceful and quiet. And
one so of them retired of popes, a thing that hasn't happened since the Middle Ages.
Which is fine. Yeah, very sure. Peaceful. It's okay. Like he wasn't kidnapped or murdered. But you go back into the Middle Ages and you go back and you find like there's a bit with like people invading Rome so they can be Pope and like two people having rival ceremonies to declare themselves Pope in churches across town and then having riots in the streets over people because people have their Pope guy that they want to be Pope, like football hooligans. Like,
at one point he's in France. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's just so, like the idea is so funny.
Drama.
The drama. The hot goss.
The hot gut. The historical hot goss.
The historical hot goss.
Time detective. I'm writing that down and filing that away. I'm using that. Yeah. That's fabulous.
Dr. Emma Southern, thank you so much for joining us. We've taken up too much of your time already. It's been an honor. And a thrill. But before we let you go, any things you want to just shout out right here while we have you on mic, websites folks can go to learn more about you or what have you?
So you can find me. You can find all my things at my website, which is emmasouthern.com. Southern is not spelt like you think it is, but you can usually find it if you spell it wrong. and I'm also on Instagram. Instagram at Emma Southern. Read my books. That would be nice. Or you can listen to my podcast, which is called History is Sexy. And we answer questions about history that people don't want to research themselves and usually say that it's because of the Reformation.
That's no one expects the Protestant Reformation.
Truly.
Or the Spanish Inquisition, for that matter. For my part, I would love to shout out a couple of podcasts in addition to Emma's, which is Traveling Light, which is a choose your own adventure sci-fi podcast hosted by the one and only H.R. Owen, a mutual friend of mine and Emma's. And then
British fantasy award winning
podcaster. Also, highly recommend Monstrous Agonies, which is a now complete podcast that is like an agony aunt, an advice column for creatures of the night. It's absolutely fabulous.
Wow.
And then I also lately have been marathoning Betwixt the Sheets with Kate Lister on History Hit, and Eleanor Yanaga's podcast, We're Not So Different, which is mostly about the Middle Ages, but also about historical materialism and Marxism and things like that. So many great pods out there. And thank you so much for joining us. It was so delightful to talk to you.
And whenever you have another book, we're probably going to email you again because we'd love to have you back on the podcast.
Yeah, so we would love to hype it up. And dear listener, you can find all of Emma's books at your local public library.
That's right. You're at this library.
Yes.
Cheers. Emma, thank you so much. Have a great evening, I guess, and the rest of your day.
Yeah, it's afternoon now. All right. I'm going to finish cooking the chili that I now have in my eye. But yeah.
We'll be in touch over email soon. Stay tuned.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. So nice to meet you.
That was our chat with Emma Southern, coming to us live. It was, we know for sure, 4 o'clock-ish her time.
You should have seen Jeff before, while we were trying to get this thing scheduled. He was like, wait, what's the time difference? Because the US clocks have sprung forward, but the UK clocks haven't yet. So it's this weird space of like 3 weeks where we're only 4 hours behind Belfast.
Here we are.
And we triple checked it.
Yep.
It worked. Nobody was in the email like, where are you? I'm on the Zoom. No.
So
we did it.
Highly recommend, obviously, both of these books that we discussed, but she has written other books out there in the world. And also, if you just heard, she is also the host of a podcast called History is Sexy.
It's a fabulous podcast. I really enjoy it. They tackle a bunch of just fun questions, including what was up with the Borgias. There's a three-parter on Rasputin that ends with a close reading and historical fact check of the Boney M. Bop Ra Ra Rasputin, Russia's greatest love machine. So I had a lot of fun marathoning that podcast when I first discovered it. And good stuff all around. Go out and read some good nonfiction, why don't you?
As we said about 5 or 6 episodes ago, nonfiction can be fun. History can be fun. And crazy.
Yes.
And wild and full of hot goss. Folks at home, thanks for listening to another episode of A Little Too Quiet. It's the Ferndale Library Podcast, and it's brought to you by the Friends of the Ferndale Library. If you want to find more information about how to support this podcast, go to ferndalefriends.org. Of course, always shouting out John Duffy for providing us music to open and close each episode. By the way, he's going to be here in the library live on April 21st performing during our art exhibition. Anyway, remember to rate, review, subscribe, and tell your friends about this fun little podcast called A Little Too Quiet. We'll be back next week with more. Thanks for listening.